come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon, and I am sitting in Studio B, incredibly excited for the show we are about to do on Words on a Wire. My guest today is Michael Jaime Becerra, who, in my opinion, is one of the best novelists and fiction writers out there today. He has two books. One is called Every Night is Ladies' Night, and the other one is called This Time Tomorrow, and both of them are incredible, and this is going to be a great show. Also, on Poetic License, hopefully you won't get tired of my voice because I have a few things I want to say, darn it. So stick around. But before he gets here, I want to talk about last night. He's staying at a hotel here in town, and I went to go pick him up to take him out to dinner, show him around a little bit. And he's with his wife, Elizabeth, and they are just like the cutest couple in the world. I mean, they have been together since high school. They got great energy. I liked being around them. And so I picked him up. And I wanted to show them a little bit of the University of Texas. And I pointed out that the buildings here are like Tibetan buildings. And if you look at El Paso, University of Texas, if you're not from here, you may not know this. But if you look at it from a distance, it's these Tibetan architectural buildings nestled in these desert mountains. And it's incredibly beautiful. And so they were stunned. And then I showed him a little bit of Juarez. I took him to the bridge. I drove him to Segundo Barrio. And then we went and had a very nice dinner. His wife will be here too, but she's not going to say anything. She's just going to sit in the background because she doesn't like the attention that apparently us writers seem to crave. We had a neuroscientist on the show the other day, and he was saying that creative types have a sort of psychosis in the sense that they always must assert their opinion in one way or another. And so I guess in that sense, we're a little psychotic, but not in a bad way. We're not going to carry a knife and follow you home. So join us with Michael Jaime Becerra. He's about to come into the studio. Stick around. Michael Jaime Becerra is author of the novel This Time Tomorrow. He grew up in El Monte, California, in a working-class suburb, and received his MFA from UC Irvine, and he currently teaches at the University of California, Riverside. His short story collection, Every Night is Ladies' Night, was named one of the best books of the year by the Washington Post and the San Francisco Chronicle. Michael Jaime Becerra, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel. It's a pleasure to be here.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad you're here, and I love your books. You have two of them that are published, that are out already, both very critically acclaimed and from wonderful publishers. Every Night is Ladies' Night, which is a collection of stories in your very first book. And then your novel is This Time Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Let's back up a little bit before we get to the books. Let's talk a little bit about where you teach.
Yeah, I teach at UC Riverside in the Department of Creative Writing there. And
You're a tenured professor.
I'm a tenured associate professor. I'm the graduate advisor for our MFA program, and I'm very busy. But it's a dream job in many respects because that was the school I attended as an undergrad.
Oh, wow. That must be amazing, walking down the same hallways.
Not the same hallways. I mean, we're in a new building now. But, I mean, I remember when I was a student, I was there in the early to mid-90s, and the creative writing department had maybe 20, 25 people in it. And now as an undergraduate major, we're up to 250 undergrads, one of the biggest departments on campus and really vibrant as far as the community goes at UCR.
250 undergrads in creative writing?
Yeah, yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah, it's a fast-growing major. In our MFA program, we broke one of our application records this year, so it was a record-breaking year for us in terms of applications.
How many did you get?
We're over 200 now.
That's amazing. Wow. Except being on the committee must be tough.
It's good. We've been able to form various committees. So we have a poetry committee, we have a fiction committee, a nonfiction committee, and then we sort of segment. Everybody gets their set. So everybody's reading the same amount of work, and then each set gets looked at twice, so we're not overlooking anyone. And this was a good application year for us. We're in the process right now of admissions, and I've been speaking to prospective MFAs from all over the country, a couple internationally in some cases. So there's a young man in London who is an emerging science fiction writer who is incredibly talented, a woman in Canada who's an incredible poet that we're hoping to get to come to UCR, people in Michigan, Iowa, Indiana, the Northwest, Portland, Seattle. So it's going to be really a big, diverse cohort. And I think the last several years, that's the trajectory the program's been on.
Out of all those 200-plus, how many are you going to accept?
14.
14, wow.
Yeah, so we're looking at—
They got to be good.
They have to be excellent. And the approach has been quality over quantity. I'd rather have good people than to have full seats.
Absolutely.
And so—
Totally agree.
You know, we're looking at 5 in fiction, hopefully, 5 in nonfiction and 4 in poetry. Last year, we had a really strong, unprecedentedly strong application pool in poetry. There were 12 people that we could have easily admitted into the program. And in nonfiction last year, it was very poor. There was, you know, the committees had trouble agreeing on who we should apply. So we made offers to 2. Both of them ended up not coming to UCR. We lost out to Iowa in one case.
And damn, Iowa. They're always taking the good students.
Well, I mean, there's that. But on the other hand, I mean, that created opportunities for us in poetry.
Absolutely.
And so we had 6 poets come in when we were originally looking at maybe 4. And we have a really robust, diverse poetry cohort right now that are doing really good work. So, again, I go back to this idea of having quality people over just the number of seats filled.
Right. You know, when people lament how bad the state of literature is today and, you know, how there's no more good writers, I think, oh, bull crap. You ought to read our students.
Yeah, exactly. I feel exactly the same way. And there's also that critique of the MFA program sort of just creating, homogenizing literature. I haven't seen that at all. Mm-hmm. We look to pull writers that write differently.
Right.
And we're pulling from all various parts of the country, writers that are different ages, different frames of reference, different experiences that are informing their writing. Yeah, we are not looking for the same type of person.
And you have the, I would consider it a privilege to be able to work with a man we've had on the show 3 times, yeah. Juan Felipe Herrera.
Yeah, yeah. Juan Felipe, I'm proud to say, is my neighbor. His office is next door to mine. And
is he crazy? Is he crazy? I'm funny all the time.
he's the best word I heard to describe Juan Felipe is that he's frothy. He's a very frothy personality. And, you know, I get to talk with Juan Felipe on a weekly basis about what he's working on, what I'm working on. We talk about music. We talk about poetry. We talk about sentences, teaching. And his approach is I'm very sort of on the page, in craft. Let's look at the sentences. Let's look at all of that. And Juan Felipe is just very bright and creative in his approaches. His students walk into his classrooms expecting one thing, and he surprises them with something else. Yeah. And that's both with the grads and the undergrads. And that, to me, is incredible, to be able to bring that degree of creativity, that degree of freshness
right.
to the approach to the work. And I think that's a privilege just to be next to that as a colleague, and definitely for our students to be exposed to someone who is constantly looking to reinvent poetry, who is not... You know, he's not content to sit back and, you know, do the same thing twice.
Oh.
Yeah, so.
You have 2 books out. Both of them are from incredible presses. Your first book is Every Night is Ladies' Night, and it's put out by HarperCollins.
Yep.
And it's a collection of stories, and that rarely happens. I mean, very few writers get a first book of stories by a New York press. How did that happen? I mean, it's an amazing book.
Thank you.
But how did it happen? Tell us the history of that.
Yeah, sure. Ladies' Night began a while ago, certainly, and it grew through my time at UC Irvine's MFA program. And so Ladies' Night is essentially my master's thesis that I did at UCI. I entered that program as a retiring poet. So I had studied poetry as an undergraduate. And,
really?
Yeah. And toward the end of that, one of the things that UCR emphasizes is cross-genre study. So you have a primary genre. As an undergraduate, that was poetry for me. And toward the end of my time there, I was forced to take fiction workshops. And it was right around then, I took my first fiction workshop with Susan Strait, who is still with us. She's a most distinguished fiction writer. She's receiving the Los Angeles Times Kirshner Award for Lifetime Achievement at the Book Festival this year. But I took my first workshops with her, and it was in that class with Susan that I realized I was writing. My poems were scenes with line breaks.
Nice.
And that if I put 6 or 7 or 8 of these together, I had a story. And I came out of that. My undergraduate thesis was a collection of poems that was published by a local press. And I thought, you know, I really wanted to do this on a larger scale with fiction. I wanted to write a set of interrelated stories. And so when I arrived at Irvine, I only had one of the stories completed, Practice Tattoos. And then for the next 2 years, I just worked on drafts of new things, looking to build and to grow. And that was certainly a big part of the process. Before I had arrived at Irvine, the longest thing I had written was Practice Tattoos. And in that draft form, I think it was like 10 or 11 pages. When I completed the program 2 years later, I completed a novella, Media Vuelta, that's in Ladies' Night, and that was 70 pages. And one of my readers who read that said, you know, I read this and I felt like you could have just gone on for another 200 pages if you wanted to. And when she said that, I felt, you know what, like, you're right. Like, I do feel like that. I feel like I had developed a new set of muscles, a new set of creative muscles, a new set of understanding of what I could do with my work. And that was just part of the process of being in that program, the pressure of having to write and to produce for the workshop, and just having a really supportive, really warm workshop environment. My colleagues there were treating me incredibly well. You hear these horror stories sometimes about the MFA, about sort of divisive or competitive
workshops.
Right, or
how mean they are in workshops.
Clickishness and all of that. And that was not my experience at all.
Maybe you were in the click.
It could have been that, but yeah.
No, but I agree. I totally agree. I think the MFA experience is, you know, pretty much how you receive it and what you do with it.
Yeah, so I was very fortunate in that regard. And it being in that kind of cocoon allowed me to take risks, allowed me to try points of view that I hadn't written from before, allowed me to experiment with dialogue in ways that I hadn't before. I really felt like I wanted to push the envelope there. And it's hard to be able to do that if you don't feel that there's going to be support for you. And so what I was able to accomplish at Ladies' Night, I really attribute a lot to the teaching that I had there and also just to the colleagues I had in my program.
I didn't know that that you had started out as a poet, but it makes a lot of sense, because one of the things I love about Every Night is Ladies' Night, it's really a fantastic book, is the language. I could just get lost in the language and not even care where it's taking me, but write it. And so that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, I came into that book with a very strong sense of what the line should be, and that just comes from that awareness of a poetry, just looking at word choice, how word choice speaks back to character. How word choice is reflective of point of view, punctuation even, just the different signals. What's the difference between a comma and a dash? You know, the different intensities of those. The power of a quotation mark, the idea of, you know, if it's in quotations, the person actually said that versus reporting. I talk a lot about this a lot with my students, just particularly with dialogue. We talk about volume. There are things that need to be heard brightly and loudly. Right. So let's put those in quotation marks, whereas there are things that can be reported and to good effect to have that lower volume for those incidental things.
Do you ever find when you're writing fiction, you follow the language and it just takes you in places that just surprise the heck out of you?
Absolutely. And that happens a lot with image for me. A lot of the fiction that I write, it grows out of a memory, and you're attaching language to that memory, right? You're attaching, what are the words? What are the images, the things that come out? How am I going to say that? And then I think for me, point of view tends to come out of that.
Right.
I mean, certainly character comes out of that, and character is my driving mechanism as a storyteller. I've been writing this story for the last couple of months now, and it stalled out in places, and it picked up in other places, and where it's picking up, it's a lot of it is the language. There's a windstorm, a scene with a windstorm that I'm working on right now. Just describing the scene, the language that I'm using for that is helping me feel rooted in the story in a way that I hadn't felt rooted previously.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most rewarding experiences for a fiction writer, is when you're writing a story or writing prose and you're following language, you're following image, and then suddenly something happens and you go, oh my gosh,
yeah, absolutely.
I had no idea.
No, I mean, that exact situation happened to me a couple of weeks ago working on this story, and I arrived at a bent television antenna. And remember, these are the old aerials that people would put on top of their houses, and you have to go up and adjust them to get the reception. We could never get Channel 2 because the San Gabriel Mountains were supposedly in the way. And I was just kind of following, just, you know, what are the things that we're going to see after a windstorm? And this memory of a bent aerial came to me. And it's the idea of, like, the bent aerial, the sound of that really registered
with
me.
That's a great image.
Yeah. And so the line that I ended up writing was that, you know, the boy picks up the bent aerial and it's bent, but he's not strong enough to bend it. And so I'm trying to get at, like, the power of the storm that they had just endured. And that was just, it's an image that kind of occurred. When I sat down that morning, it wasn't in my mind. And I just followed the language, like you said. I followed the images that I thought might be there. And I arrived at that. And I arrived at a point where I was able to kind of illustrate just this boy's, not only his physical weakness, but really his lack of power in the world that he has.
I want to ask you one more question about Every Night is Ladies' Night,
sure,
which is your first published book.
This is my first national publication. Yeah.
With Harper's, which is not a bad first.
I was very fortunate, yeah.
I can't overemphasize how rare it is for a collection of stories to be published by HarperCollins or by any New York press. But tell us about how it came about to be published. What happened? Did you find an agent? I mean,
sure.
Give us a little, just a quick narrative on that, and then we'll get to your novel.
All right. So I concluded my time at UCI, and my thesis advisors were very excited about this being sent out. And so the next step for me was to find an agent, and that took a year and a half of approaching specific people individually, people that I had researched or that I had met at conferences. And the person that became my agent was ultimately the agent who represented the third reader on my thesis, Ann Patchett. Mm. And once I made contact with her, we had this wonderful conversation where she understood a lot of the goals that I had with the book, some of which were to not present Chicano characters in the same way that we had seen some of them. I have a cholo in my book, but he enjoys algebra because it's nice. It's mysterious to him in ways that other things in his life aren't. And she understood that. I remember very vividly the conversation. The book was originally titled Songs for Young Cowboys. And she said, you know, I don't think that's going to work for a variety of reasons. And I'm looking over your story titles, and I see Every Night is Ladies' Night as a story title, and I think this could be the book title. And when she said that, I realized all the female characters I had written in the book and really the power that they occupied. And that reversed my whole perception of what the book could be.
Yeah, because the other title almost sounds too masculine for the collection.
It sounds too masculine.
One of the great things about it is you're really subverting the expectations of a male Latino.
Yeah.
When in this book, it's the women characters are incredibly developed, and they got a lot of depth, and they're central.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I think that had been a goal, but it had to be my conscious goal, at least at the outset. And after that comment, after that insight, this is the person I want. And so she became my agent. I formally said, "Will you be my agent now?" She said, "Yes, of course." We sent the book out on a Thursday, and the following Monday, HarperCollins had called back with an offer. It moved that quickly.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
I'm very fortunate. That was a time when HarperCollins had a Latino imprint, Rayo. And
Rene Alegría was the
director of that imprint, and that was an imprint that gave opportunity to a lot of writers, myself included, to put us in
and
a
Ben. Ben
yeah,
Ben
your
Sines
co-host Ben Sines.
Then,
I have his galley still that Rene sent to me, nice. And that put us into a national conversation that really hadn't been occurring on that scale before, I think. I mean, certainly there have been Chicano and Latino writers publishing nationally, but this was an entire imprint that was dedicated to that, and it was groundbreaking in that regard.
Okay, we're running out of time, but sure. I wanted to talk a little bit about your latest book, This Time Tomorrow, and then if we can, briefly about what you're working on now. But first, This Time Tomorrow. This novel came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah, with St. Martin's.
Another excellent press. What was the process from Ladies' Night to this novel?
One of the things that I set out to do is that, I'll do Ladies' Night 2.0. I'll write another set of stories. And I wanted to write a novella, and I started writing this novella about a man whose wife or future wife, a man whose then girlfriend, is coming from a traditional Mexican household. And for people out there who may not know this, in traditional Mexican households, you don't leave until you're married. Mm-hmm. And this is for the men and the women. And so he's dating this woman, Joyce, who's a Chicana. She's in her mid-30s, but she's never left home because she's never married. And there's a tension that starts to creep into their relationship as a result of that. And I started writing this, and I got to the end of that first part, and I thought, there's so much more here. Mm. He has a daughter. People wanted to hear from Joyce's perspective on this, all this. And so the novel is really told in three parts. Gilbert, who is the first primary character, and then we see Joyce's take on things. And then we jump ahead 6 years, and we get Anna, who is Gilbert's daughter. We get her take on things as well.
Nice, nice. In a few words, if you can, what are you working on now?
I just finished this essay called Speakeasy Tacos, which is going to be part of the Los Angeles Atlas, which is coming out in 2015. And so last summer, I spent the entire summer working as a taquero catering tacos for people all over Southern California.
No way.
Yeah, and writing about the experience for this anthology. So that's going to be coming out next year.
Wow, that is dedication. That is
research. It was intense, and it was a lot of fun, and it was a powerful experience for me, and I'm happy and proud to have it be part of this book.
Wow, that's awesome. We'll look out for that. All right, thank you for joining us. We're talking to Michael Jaime Becerra, author of two books of fiction, Every Night is Ladies Night, and the novel This Time Tomorrow. Thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel.
My name is Nancy Lechuga. I am a local poet, and I will be reading to you today a poem by National Book Award winner Mary Zibist from her new book, Incarnadine. This poem is called Close Reading. But let us return to the words of the poem. There is more here than a girl on a trampoline, more than an up and down melancholy movement. Notice, for instance, how far girl appears from the brandy-colored branches of the pine, and notice how close girl appears to silver bar, the one that intermittently flashes in the afternoon light. How she must long for it, separated only by looks at. Since this is the work of a humanist poet, we can assume that when she seems to hear a low whistle, such as her sister described in line 2, she is really only hearing the high-pitched hum of her own mind as it unwinds. This suggests that if she had ever really given herself to the piano or the violin, she would know what notes were possible and therefore how to make a song of herself. See all those capital E's in the passage with their lines like oven racks placed on the middle rung? The irony is that this should be a domestic scene, but instead, she is forever bouncing on her trampoline with the wind in her ears. Though her hands seem to reach toward the metal bar that hangs just above and before her, we can't know if she will ever grasp it. If she does, she will forfeit her own status as a girl on a trampoline. Poor girl. She wants to do what's right, and she knows that we are watching. We are told she is concerned about fair play, but consider how close fair play is to foreplay. She wants it, but she doesn't know how it goes. When we direct our gaze at anything, it collides. She goes on bouncing, and when she tears the lavender scarf from her neck and says, "Oh," we well might think of zero, as it floats down against the backdrop of the endless, dust-colored clouds. It could only symbolize something terrible as a lung torn from her in its idle languor earthward. This was Closed Reading by Mary Zibist.
I'm Daniel Chacon. I'm calling in from Los Angeles, where I'm doing research for my next book. On my way to Hollywood, I decided to stop in Little Ethiopia for some coffee. Little Ethiopia, like other ethnic neighborhoods, Little Italy, Little Japan, is an area in the city made up of immigrants, in this case, from Ethiopia. There's plenty of Ethiopian restaurants and Ethiopian grocery stores, and in coffee shops, Ethiopians drink sweet Ethiopian coffee. There's even an Ethiopian cultural center and a bookstore where you can find books and newspapers published in Oromo and Amhara. It's a beautiful place. But it got me thinking. Imagine you're a poor Ethiopian teenager. You're tending your goats in the highlands, and you hear on the radio or on a TV playing in some cafe you pass by that in Los Angeles, California, the place where they make movies, there's a neighborhood called Little Ethiopia. It's an urban representation of your own country and your own people. Wouldn't that blow your mind? Wouldn't you want to see it in real life? you're a poor teenager from a poor family, and you know you'll never be able to go there. So little Ethiopia, California would forever remain a place of your imagination. That would blow my mind. Think about it. If you found out that in some faraway country, I mean really far away, a country you know you'll never see, there was a neighborhood called Little USA, wouldn't you want to see it? Poor immigrants from the U.S. settled there from places like Waco, Texas, and Kettlesburg, Kentucky. And they rented apartments and bought houses, opened American stores and American businesses. Wouldn't you want to go there? What kind of restaurants would there be in Little USA? Maybe a cafe called Auntie M, where they sell bologna sandwiches with Velveeta cheese on white bread, and they serve tall glasses of sweet iced tea. Of course, you know there'd have to be a hot dog vendor and a place that sells fresh squeezed lemonade just like home. If you walk through the streets of Little USA, you might see an American grandma putting apple pies in the window to cool off. But a little red-headed American boy is walking by in denim overalls, a fishing pole over his shoulder, whistling Yankee Doodle, and he sniffs those apple pies, and he can't help it. He's going to have some of that pie. He steals one from the window, and he goes behind the schoolyard, and darn it, if that boy don't eat up the entire pie. Oh, but he gets a bad stomachache afterwards, so he really learns his lesson. I'm sorry, Grandma Smith. I shouldn't have stolen that pie. In Little USA, there'd be a general store on Main Street where Mr. Whistle sells everything an American family needs. Charmin toilet paper, baseball bat, white sheets with holes in the eyes already outlined so you know where to cut. The old man talking outside around the pickle barrel would say stuff like, when we were kids back in the good old USA, we had to guess where to cut the eyes out of a white sheet. And of course, after a generation of living in Little USA, American boys and girls would become less American. They would lose the old ways and begin to adopt the values of the dominant culture. They would forget their English, and they would speak the national language with only a few American idioms sprinkled in. Bukalibika midu naridu tutabraba. They would reduce their U.S. heritage to little American flags that they'd stick on the back windows of their cars. And when they went to the universities, they would form American clubs. And during American Awareness Week, they could plan a bunch of activities, softball games, three-legged races, a good old-fashioned lynching. But, of course, this little USA is only a place in my imagination. If there were really a little USA in some distant land, the immigrants would be dirt poor, having fled this country for a better life, to escape oppression and persecution. So the more likely scenario is that the Americans would be dark-skinned. Little USA would have a main thoroughfare, Cesar Chavez Boulevard, and it would intersect with Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue. And on every corner, you would find a burrito stand and a barbecue shack and a cafe where they serve big bowls of pho. They would speak a language you could only hear in Little USA, a mixture of English and Spanish and Tagalog and Vietnamese and Ebonics and so many other tongues, and some words from those languages would be sprinkled in with the dominant language. Imagine it. Wouldn't that be a beautiful tongue? How would a sentence sound? I'm Daniel Chacon for Words on a Wire.
I'd like to thank a man that I now consider my friend, Michael Jaime Becerra, for joining us in the studio today, and his lovely wife, Elizabeth, who didn't say anything but nonetheless was here and brought her very positive energy into the studio. And Norma Martinez, our producer, and thank you for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire. Join us next week on the same time and the same Bat Channel. I'm Daniel Chacon, and don't forget, the next book you read may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.